you have a Bible or a way to access your Bible, I want to encourage you to find your way to the Old Testament book of Deuteronomy today, Deuteronomy chapter 6. And some of you say, well, hey, weren't we there last week? Yeah, we're going to read that same passage again. We're in this series called The Family of God. And we've already talked about sort of the Genesis story about how God created family, not just to us individually, but family in the image of God. And then last week we talked about kind of the environment that it takes to sort of, you know, hey, once we realize we're not a perfect people, we're a sinful people, what kind of environment do we need? And we talked about Deuteronomy 6. Well, today what I want us to look at is something a little bit different than that. I want to look specifically at what some people today call dysfunctional families. Now, the old definition of a dysfunctional family is every family, you know, because to a certain degree, all families have a certain level of dysfunction. But what we're really talking about today are spiritual dysfunctions. And I'm going to give you six of those as we work through our message this morning. But, you know, as I think about family for us, you know, for our family, the hard part was when we went from just my wife and I to a child, and then we added another child. And when we added the second child, absolutely everything changed. I mean, just absolutely changed. And especially just the idea the baby comes home, he's crying, you know, he's screaming. You heard about that little boy, Johnny, has got a little brother, came home just crying. He said to Mom, Mom, where did he come from? Where did this kid come from? He was just screaming and crying. Mommy said, from heaven. Johnny thought about it for a second. He says, and I can see why they threw him out, you know. Well, there's some of us that kind of realize that about our own families. We kind of, there's some challenges there. Well, God understands that. And when God created the family with Adam and Eve, and then we all messed up, God had another solution. When Adam failed, he sent Abraham. And when Abraham failed, he sent Moses. And he gave the people some understanding about the kind of environment and the kind of factors it takes to have for someone to be formed in the image of God. And that's what we're going to be looking at today. If you have a Bible, I want to invite you to turn to Deuteronomy 6. And I want to read this passage to you again. Last week I told you that this contains the verse that Jesus says is the most important in the Bible. The greatest commandment in the entire Bible. It also contains the most holy prayer in all of Scripture prayed by Jewish people throughout history and throughout the world. And right now, at the Wailing Wall in Jerusalem, there is a rabbi, Orthodox priest, praying the prayer that we're going to read in just a moment. These are the commands and decrees, Deuteronomy 6 says, and the laws the Lord your God directed me to teach you to observe in the land that you're crossing the Jordan to possess, so that your children, I mean, isn't it interesting? He's so concerned about their children. Your children and their children after them, your kids and your grandkids, may fear the Lord your God as long as you are keeping all his decrees and commands I give you, so that you may enjoy long life, which is interesting because a lot of times we forget that God cares about that kind of thing. Hear, Israel, and be careful to obey so that it may go well with you, and you may increase greatly in a land flowing with milk and honey, just as the Lord, the God of your ancestors, promised you. And here's that prayer that's prayed by the faithful Jew every day. Shema, O Israel, or hear, O Israel, the Lord our God, the Lord is one. And here is the greatest commandment Jesus says is in the Bible. Love the Lord your God with all your heart, with all your soul, and with all your strength. These commands I give you today are to be on your hearts. That's very interesting. And then he says this, impress them on your children. Talk about them when you sit at home and when you walk along the road and when you lie down and when you get up, and tie them as symbols on your hands and bind them on your foreheads and write them on the door frames of your house and on your gates. You know, I was just thinking about sort of this idea of the dysfunctional family. And I think there's a lot of us who are sort of Christians, we kind of think, well, man, if I just did this right or got this right or got this right in my life, my family is going to go great. But if you really think about it in the Bible, the story of the Bible is not how to have a perfect family. You could almost say it's the opposite. It's look at all the messed up families. And, you know, you could just kind of make a list. I did this morning. I was just kind of going through just thinking, you know, Adam and Eve, goodness, they made some mistakes. Cain and Abel, I mean, one of them killed the other. Abraham and his servant girl ended up with Ishmael, Lot and his daughters, I don't know about if you know that story or not, Isaac and Rebekah, they couldn't decide which son they loved more, and Esau and Jacob ended up, you know, hating each other. Laban tricked his nephew Jacob into marrying a different daughter, that's a little weird. Judah and all of his prostitutes, Aaron and his sons who did not take God seriously, Gideon and his son who murdered, Samson and all of his problems, Eli and his Samuel, David, on and on and on the story goes of all the biblical families. I mean, it's like how to mess it up. It's kind of the biblical story. Well, this morning as we think about this, I want to take us in a new direction, but I want you just to imagine, because I didn't create this as a visual, but I want you to imagine a line that's just running straight across. And you've seen these things like a pendulum, or on one side is parents are in absolute control, right? And then on the other side of that pendulum, if you will, the child is in absolute control. Now, I want you just to think about that this morning as we work through this, because that's really one of the big issues involved in this whole conversation. So the first thing on your outline there, if you want to fill this in, is one end of that spectrum. They are out of control, right? So the kids are out of control. And I want to give you three dysfunctional models of parenting that will result in the children being out of control. Number one is the absent parent. The absent parent. Now, I mean, there's really no more out of control a parent can have than if they're just physically not there. And, you know, we all probably grew up in families or we've had children and we've come to terms with this, and there's a lot of feelings about this. Mom was there, dad was there or wasn't there. And then, you know, the kids will sometimes say some of these same things. But we get this weird idea in our minds, and it's part of our culture today, that we don't have to spend time with our kids. We just have to spend quality time with our kids. And I told you before, I know a great Greek word for that. It's called baloney. Because the reality is there's no such thing as quality time. It's like saying there's quality money. You know, I borrow $100 from you, and I'm going to give you some money back. So, you know what, I'll tell you what, I'm going to give you $5. It's not much, but it's quality money. How's that, you know? It just doesn't work. In real life, time is the most valuable thing there is. And so what we do sometimes is we put greater value on something else. We think that maybe that moment of losing the tooth or hitting the home run or the dance recital is not that important. But it actually, those moments become some of the most important moments of life. Louise Hart, who is a very famous individual as it relates to understanding children, once said, "The best thing to spend on your child is your time." And you just think about that in terms of this conversation. The absent parent is the parent who really doesn't have the opportunity. And the problem is a lot of times with a lot of parents is they get focused on stuff rather than the relationship. They're too busy planning for the big things and forget the small things are the big things. Sometimes they want to teach their kids to achieve, to succeed. And sometimes kids grow up too slow or too fast, and they lose a sense of self-worth and a sense of intimacy. Now, you just think about that. You think about this passage in Deuteronomy, and it says, okay, this is what you need to do, moms and dads. When you wake up with your kids in the morning, you talk to them about God, you impress on God. As you walk with them through the road, impress on them the things of God. All through their lives, you're impressing on them the truths of who God is. But how can you do that if you're not present in those situations of life? So one is the absent parent. A second one is the I can't say no parent. I wish I had one of those. You know what I mean? I was the kid that always wished I had a parent that just said, yeah, you can have anything you want. I didn't have one of those parents. The I can't say no parent. You know, the problem of a parent who just says I can't say no is there's this term called enabling. Some of you know that term. And enabling means that through action or inaction, you help someone to indulge in destructive behavior. And so a lot of times what happens is an I can't say no parent, what they do is they actually contribute to something that's destructive. And for us in our house, it's the, you know, we're all a part of the iPad generation in our house. And we have to really be careful with this because our kids are like, they're addicted to it, you know? And just that's just kind of the generation. We all grew up in that. And there's like this chronic boredom that comes out of this. We have to think about this, the I can't say no parent. What's the issue here? Well, you know, Jesus so many times talks about how he came to set us free. And the Bible talks about this message of we can be free and we can be free from so many things. The I can't say no parent actually keeps their children from being free. Bruce Barton is a famous man in American history. He was one of the leaders of our country. And he lived in the post-World War II generation. He had seen all of the brave men of our country and women who went away to fight in our nation's wars and fought on the battlefield to defend for freedom for our country. But he said this, and it's interesting. He said, what a curious phenomenon it is that you can get men to die for the liberty of the world who will not make a little sacrifice that is needed to free themselves from their own individual bondage. And you know, you think about it, it's really true, isn't it? A lot of us are willing, hey, man, I'm ready to go. But what about those small things that we need to be free from in our lives? There's a third dysfunctional example of this, and this is sometimes called the double-minded parent. That has nothing to do with schizophrenia, by the way. It comes from a word in the Bible that means two minds. And this kind of a parent is sort of the one that says, I want the best of both worlds, you know? I want to go to church on Sunday, but I also want to have the best of both worlds. Robert Collier once said, one might as well try to ride two horses moving in different directions, which I think that's hard, as to try to maintain in equal force two opposing or contradictory sets of desires. And yet the Bible talks about these people, and I think there are probably a lot of them within kind of the church world, who can't decide who they're really trying to pursue in their life. James talked about these people in James 1:8. He says a person is double-minded. It's the word two psychos, two minds. And then, you know, Jesus said something about it. In Matthew, Jesus said, no one can serve two masters. Either you're going to hate one and love the other, or you're going to be devoted to one and despise the other. And he gave an example. You cannot serve both God and money. Think about that as a parent. We're setting examples for our kids and for our grandchildren. And the question is, are they seeing that God is the focus? God is the primary thing? The loving the Lord your God with all of your heart, with all of your strength, with all of your, with everything. That is the focal point of your mind and your heart? Or is it like, yeah, it's kind of both. It's double-minded. So these are on one side of the spectrum. These are the ones that are out of control. But let's go to the other end of the spectrum now, number two, and talk about the ones in this other category, which is I am in control. Maybe mom, maybe dad, maybe parents. I'm in control. So what are some examples of these? Well, the first example would be the micromanager parent. Now, anybody ever have a job or you some area of life and you had to work with a micromanager, right? Some of you in marriages, you got like, you know, just, no, don't raise your hand for that. You know, micromanaging is when someone just comes along and it's like every little thing has to be exactly right the way they want it to be. And you're like, this is driving me crazy. I mean, what about what I want? What about the things that I want? The micromanager parent is the one who always knows what's best and makes all of the decisions for somebody. Now, the example that we all saw several years ago was on the cover of Time magazine. And that was Tiger Mom. Remember Tiger Mom? Amy Chua, she wrote that book called The Battle Hymn of the Tiger Mother. And she brought her ancient Chinese culture to bring the strictest things you can imagine in raising her Chinese child in the United States. And the journalist asked the question as she wrote about Tiger Mom. She said, what kind of a mother hauls her 7-year-old daughter's dollhouse out to the car, telling her it's going to be donated to the Salvation Army piece by piece if she doesn't master a difficult piano composition? I mean, that's pretty intense, isn't it? What kind of a mother, the journalist asks, informs her daughter that she's garbage, who says an A- is a bad grade, who says the only activities your children should be permitted to do are those that will eventually lead to a medal, and it better be gold. Now that sounds like, man, that's a great mom, and a lot of people read that book and probably think it's interesting, but think about what it also does. Think about the problem of that for the child, the sense of insecurity, growing up doubting themselves, am I ever going to be good enough? Think about the doctor who has to see that child and, why do you have a stomach ache? Why do you have a headache? Why do you have an eating disorder? You see, these things come out of these micromanaging parental styles. But there's a lesser version of that that some of us will be familiar with, and that's number two, the driven parent. Most moms will not be tiger moms, but they may be driven moms and driven dads. They pursue perfection. They sometimes miss sight of grace. We don't have time to waste time. College is coming. You may be 1 year old, but let's get ready for it. Let's start working on the SAT, you know? Sometimes they give kids everything because they didn't have it. Sometimes they push their kids to take on the legacy that they can carry on to the next generation. But inside, these children live with anxiety, and they often find themselves depressed. We've got to think about the consequences of these things. But then there's a sixth dysfunctional parental style, and that's the critical parent. And I don't mean just sometimes criticizing. I mean the parent that says everything is wrong. With cruel words, the parent who says you need thick skin, it's like you need metal armor. And these children wake up and grow up in a world where they feel insecure, they feel pessimistic, and they feel they got to push and bully other kids around. These are all these dysfunctional, we could go forever in these lists and talk about all these things. A lot of us could do that in this room today. But what Deuteronomy is trying to do, and what God's trying to do, is he's trying to lead us to another thought, which is, look at the pendulum. I'm in control, they're in control, and instead of it being two-dimensional, let's make it three-dimensional and draw it up into a sort of a triangular shape that points upward toward God. And what if there's a third option, which is God is in control? What if there's a third option that says, my understanding of family comes down from God, and the purpose of my family is to reflect the image of God and to accomplish the activity and mission of God in the world? That's what Genesis talks about. That's the purpose of all of this. It's not about me being in control or them being in control. It is about God being in control. That is the beginning and the end of the Christian life. C.S. Lewis was not a Christian. He became a Christian. Lewis said, I gave in and I admitted that God was God. There's got to be a point where we say, you know what, we're not in charge, we're not in control. And this is one of the things Deuteronomy is teaching these parents and teaching us today. So what does spiritual parenting look like? Well, let's look at some of the things this passage shows us. Number one, spiritual parents know that kids belong to God. Forever in Israel, there was a practice. They would take an eight-year-old and they would dedicate them to God. In fact, when you're reading Luke's gospel, sometimes you'll read that happened to Jesus. Mary and Joseph took Jesus to the temple and they said, you know what? This child is God's. And it was sort of this moment where they sort of realize this is a gift from God. This is created in the image of God and it's all about God. And we do that in our church. We have dedications. And one of the things, you know what we do at dedication? We read Deuteronomy 6 and we say, this child belongs to God. Spiritual parents know kids belong to God. They can say something like this: I recognize that my child has been entrusted to me by God and that I need his guidance to raise her or him. No kids belong to God. Number two, spiritual parents develop character despite living in a fallen culture. That's the story of Deuteronomy. So like God takes Israel out of Egypt. They've been pagans. They've been in a pagan land. But I told you before, it's not hard for God to get you out of Egypt. What's hard is for God to get the Egypt out of you. It's not hard for God to get you in church. It's not hard for God to do some miracle in your life. What is hard for God to do is to change your heart and to change your character and to change who you are as it relates to who he is. And the role and the job of a parent is to help to do that. A parent like this will say, I know I live in a sinful world, but I will seek to put God's character on display in my home in everyday situations. And then third, a spiritual parent goes beyond behavior. You know, the story of the Bible is a story of people who mess up. And you got to kind of ask yourself a question like, well, what's God doing then? If he just knows Adam's going to mess up and he knows everybody's going to make all these mistakes. And if you really go, you know, beneath the surface, you're like, what is God really into? In the Bible, it's he wants your heart. I mean, I'm telling you, God can't do anything with a person who thinks they're perfect, but a person whose heart belongs to him, God can do anything with that person. And spiritual parenting is just about trying to cultivate into the life of a child a heart for God, a desire to please God. And so a parent like this will say, I know there's a higher calling as a parent than just controlling my child's behavior. It's forming faith into their life. It's forming something in their heart that, man, nothing can take away from them. And then fourth, when you look at it, it is to kindle. I like this word kindle because the image of just a fire that's about to burn out. It is to kindle a passion for the Lord. through your own zeal for the Lord. To kindle a passion for the Lord through your own zeal for God. I think a lot of times parents, what they do is they kind of go, all right, I want my kids to love the Lord, but you know, I don't know if I'm going to really do that much. And it doesn't work that way. We have to go, okay, God, I am sold out for you. I am passionate for you. I am running after you. I am chasing after you. I am longing for the things that you long for. And I guarantee you that when your life is like that, people are going to notice, and some of those people are the people who are like with you all the time. And they're going to go, your kids, you know, those of you with kids, have they seen you pray? Have they seen you worship? This happens in the overflow of our life. A spiritual parent can say, I seek to grow spiritually myself, knowing the overflow of this will have a positive impact on my child. But I want to give you a disclaimer. Every good sermon should have a disclaimer. And the disclaimer this morning is this. If you do this, your kids are going to grow up spiritually healthy. They're going to grow up to know God, to love God, to live meaningful lives, and to recognize that, you know, there is another world. And here's the disclaimer part of that. That's totally different than the way the rest of the world lives. That's totally different than the way the culture lives. That's totally different than the pattern and the direction of the world. But it is exactly the way God wants them.